Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with a crane belonging to the Bin Laden company that toppled onto the Grand Mosque in Mecca on September the 11th, a day when Americans observed the 14th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on the United States inspired by Osama bin Laden. Robert Lacey, a British historian and author of numerous international bestsellers, including The Kingdom, and his latest, Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia, joins us to discuss the continuing construction boom in the holy cities of Mecca and Medina, where historical sites, even those where the Prophet Muhammad lived and was buried, are being erased and demolished according to the strictures of the official Saudi Wahhabi religious doctrine that is followed by the Islamic State, who are destroying the UNESCO World Heritage Site in Palmyra, Syria, and the Saudi Air Force, who are bombing museums and destroying historical antiquities in Yemen, including the oldest surviving fragment of the Quran. Then we'll explore the impact on British politics that the election of a socialist, Jeremy Corbyn, as head of the Labour Party will have, particularly in contentious policy areas such as relations with the EU and Scotland, foreign affairs, defence, and NATO membership. Harold Clark, a professor in the School of Economics, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas, joins us. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Survey at the University of Manchester, where he is a visiting professor, and his forthcoming book is Austerity and Political Choice in Britain. Then finally, we will speak with Adele Stan, a columnist at the American Prospect, where she has an article, A Nation of Sociopaths, What the Trump Phenomenon Says About America. We will discuss whether, as some are claiming, the Donald Trump candidacy is good for Democrats, or more to the point, as Adele Stan argues, is the spewing forth of racism, nativism, and misogyny into the public arena good for America? And joining us now from the UK is Robert Lacey, who's a British historian and author of numerous international bestsellers, among them The Kingdom, a study of Saudi Arabia published in 1981, Ford, The Men and the Machine, and Great Tales from British History. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Lacey.
Thank you, Ian.
And the toppling of the crane, ironically, of course, on September the 11th, it could have been infinitely worse, but when you see pictures of the skyline of Mecca literally littered with cranes, most of which I believe belong to the Bin Laden company, for some time now there's been some objections amongst a number of Muslim clerics about this construction boom. Is it? It's ostensibly the Saudi officials are saying that this is a need for modernization and to cope with the growing influx of pilgrims as Islam itself grows as a religion. But there are also critics saying that it's also being used as a part of Wahhabi religious dogma to essentially erase the country's history.
Well, I think, Ian, both statements are true. There is a demand problem for the Hajj, the pilgrimage. I mean, I think at the moment about 3 million Muslims are allowed Hajj or Umrah. Those are the two sorts of pilgrimage visas to visit Mecca and Medina every year. And that involves pretty strict rationing. If you're a Pakistani, an Indonesian, you can wait a long time to get a visa to visit the Hajj. And the Saudis are therefore quite correct in saying that there is a case for making it possible for millions more to visit the Hajj and perform. Let's not forget, this pilgrimage is something, it's one of the five pillars of Islam. It's something that every Muslim is encouraged to do. It's not quite absolutely compulsory, but it is the highlight of a Muslim's life. And my Muslim friends who have been on Hajj, even those who greatly dislike the Saudis and the way they handle the thing, found it an immensely moving experience. So let's not forget that. Having said that, in Western terms, Mecca has been absolutely desecrated by the ceaseless expansions of the Grand Mosque. Unfortunately, or as a matter of reality, certain of these rituals actually have to take place in particular spots. And the way the Saudis have dealt with the thousands, well, tens of hundreds of thousands of extra pilgrims is to sort of build things like multi-story car parks. There's a ritual where you stone the devils. You used to just walk past these pillars and throw stones. Now the Saudis, as I say, have built on either side of these pillars something that does look, from the photographs, I've never been there, like a multi-story car park, so that everybody can do it. It is a feast of ugly modern concrete, and it has been made worse by the construction of luxury hotels around the holy area, which dwarf it and make the whole place look like a Benidorm or some sort of holiday resort. And Muslims will find this an offensive thing to say, but that's how it looks to the foreign visitor. And to come to your final point, I'm afraid it is true. I'd be 99% certain, because I lived in Saudi Arabia while a lot of these issues first came to light 5-6 years ago, that there are certain Wahhabis who are taking advantage of these, well, let's say for the sake of argument, they are necessary expansion to raise, to destroy ancient monuments in Mecca, the birthplace of the Prophet Muhammad, other legendary places associated with his life and the life of his family, on the same grounds that ISIS are destroying temples and sites like Palmyra, that these sites encourage superstition. I mean, and I remember when I was living in Jeddah a few years ago, the story that these clerics had actually organized the planning so that a public urinal, a public latrine, was sited on the very spot where legend has it that the Prophet Muhammad was born.
So how do you get your head around that as a Westerner? The idea it would be like, going and finding the manger in Bethlehem and blowing it up, you know, for a Christian. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's not quite like that, Ian, because, of course, though we disagree with this Wahhabi strain of thinking and obviously abhor what ISIS is doing at an even more extreme way, there is a very strong strand of Islam which, how can I compare it to, say, to Calvinism, to fundamental evangelical Protestantism, which abhors Catholic churches, which abhors monuments to saints. I mean, the Saudis feel so strongly about this that even their kings, when they are buried in a graveyard, are just turfed into a corner of a public graveyard and covered with dust. And when you go there a few weeks later, you've no idea where the king was, because they have this fundamental abhorrence of man-made memorials in the matter of religion. That's the best way I can explain it.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Lacey, who's a British historian and author of numerous international bestsellers, among them The Kingdom, A Study of Saudi Arabia, published in 1981, Ford, The Men and the Machine, and Great Tales from British History. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia.
Ian, can I just come in there with just one other extra point? You know, we should perhaps also see this in the big contest between Sunni and Shia. The Shia, you see, Muslims, they do revere shrines. It's terribly important to them to have a tomb they can visit to revere their own ancestors, well, their own father, mother. There's definitely an element of the Sunni-Shia rivalry in this. Over in the east of Saudi Arabia, where the Shia live, you can go to a Shia graveyard and you will see old cans of Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola, littered around apparently at random. That is the way that the Shia mark the graves of their ancestors. They're not allowed to put up a tomb, so they drop what appears to be a bit of rubbish so that they can go back there in a week's time and pray. And then Sunnis will come along in the middle of the night and redistribute the rubbish to make fun of what they're doing. This is the level of what we're talking about.
But as well as the difference between the Sunni and the Shia in terms of what you just described, Robert Lacey, my understanding is also a lot of the destruction and the erasure of monuments have also been aimed at Sufi temples in Saudi Arabia. They've all been, because Mecca and Medina used to be before the Wahhab took over in the 18th century, used to have a tremendous pluralism, didn't it, Islam?
Wonderful, and that lasted even until the 1950s. There are photographs extant from the Grand Mosque in the 1950s when the House of Saud had been in power for 30, 40 years. And inside the courtyard of the Great Mosque, you could see five separate, or maybe it was four separate pavilions in which the different schools, including the Sufis, who are like the sort of Buddhists or mystics of Islam, could pray in their different ways. And that was an ancient tradition which got erased, as I say, only in the second half of the 20th century. And the Wahhabis are emphasizing their dominion over this. When I talk to Sunni friends, though, they say, don't be so patronizing. We have our beliefs. When I criticize the dreadful hotels that are overshadowing the Grand Mosque, they say, why shouldn't we build ourselves decent modern hotels when we go on pilgrimage? Why? You know, you think we should stay in the past? This is a very, very contentious area. But I must say it pains me, and of course there is this dreadful irony that all the building works in Mecca are consigned to the Bin Laden family, who are by far the largest construction company inside Saudi Arabia.
So, Robert Lacey, I moderate the UCLA Hammer Forum. We had a forum on Thursday with Senator Bob Graham, the former chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee and co-chair of the congressional inquiry into the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He's trying to get 28 pages of the secret report that his committee generated declassified, and they refer to Saudi Arabia's role in 9/11. We also had former CIA officer Robert Baer on the panel as well. And it was an interesting evening, notwithstanding that the 9/11 truthers hijacked the event, screaming and carrying on with their peculiar version of the facts as they know them, as though they don't need to be listened to anybody that actually might know something. But nevertheless, what both the senator and the former CIA officer said was that they've heard from really reliable sources within the kingdom that the kingdom could crack up. Is that anything that you've heard?
Well, Ian, I would say I've been visiting Saudi Arabia now for nearly 40 years, and last time was a year ago, just before King Salman came to the throne. And, of course, there is no throne in Saudi Arabia, so it became king. I've been hearing stories like this. The breakup, the crack-up of the kingdom is regularly forecast on the basis of family rivalries. So I would be detached from this. Having said that, the men you're talking about, if they have links with American intelligence inside Saudi Arabia, one would have to take that very seriously indeed, because the American government well understands the importance of the kingdom, and they monitor this sort of thing very closely.
Well, their guy in Riyadh, if you will, the U.S. intelligence guy, is the who has been long, and his family been long involved in the intelligence world in Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef. There are rumors that he's being marginalized by the the son of the young son of the youngest son of the king, who most people now are saying basically runs the kingdom. He's taken over defense and the oil ministries and is writing all of their writs.
You're talking about Mohammed bin Salman, bin meaning son of. You're correct. One of the surprising things that's happened with the coming to power of King Salman is the elevation of this young son of his, who, and this worries a lot of experts I know, has never really been in the West and stayed at his father's side all through his educational years. As I understand it, he is an incredibly hard-working young man, absolutely devoted to his father. The way in which he rose to this position of great power that worries people is that when his father would, on a daily basis as governor of Riyadh, meet with petitioners, 100, 150 or so, he would handle the whole affair. He would take the papers from them. You give Mohammed bin Salman a pile of papers, he will sit down and process it absolutely. And so the ailing Prince Salman, now King Salman, found a trusted blood relative, his own son, who could serve, as it were, as an extra arm. It is said that the king's mental powers wane towards the end of the day. So here's a memory. Here is mental energy. He is absolutely loyal to his father. And yes, I have heard these same rumors that he's been put in positions of authority that really are too much for him. Not just is he defense minister waging this very controversial war in Yemen, but he has been given power in economic and energy councils, which actually overrule much more experienced members of his own family, including at least one of his brothers.
Well, of course, a lot of analysts have said, Robert Lacey, that going into Yemen is a fool's errand. It's a quagmire. The Egyptians went in the 50s and 60s, and it was, in fact, a number of Egyptian generals have referred to it as their Vietnam. So, and nobody's ever conquered North Yemen, by the way. But there is some kind of peace settlement, it seems to be happening in the midst of all of this destruction that I mentioned in the opening, where the Saudi Air Force have, in fact, targeted some extraordinary antiquities, including museums with the only surviving fragment of the Quran.
Well, I'm not au fait with those particular details, but you're absolutely right. Yemen has been the graveyard of many military expeditions, including that of the House of Saud. When the House of Saud conquered Saudi Arabia in the early years of the last century, having created what is now the kingdom, they then moved south, and they wanted to take control of Yemen. And they would say that if they'd been allowed to do so, Yemen would be a much richer place. If you look at the provinces of Saudi Arabia immediately above Yemen, they are bursting with money because they get the benefit of the oil fields. But the Yemenis have resisted this. At the time of the war with Saddam Hussein, they rather perversely took the side of Saddam Hussein against Saudi Arabia. That led to millions of Yemenis being kicked out of the kingdom, an immense source of wealth and revenue for the Yemen. Well, this latest intervention, I think the Saudis had no choice. They were about to get pushed out of even Aden, or rather their clients, the democratically elected government there, were about to get pushed out by these rebels, the Houthis, allegedly agents of Iran. I think that's overstating the case. They represent a revolt against what the Saudis stand for. I think the fact that there is talk now, reports that peace talks will resume in the next week, would suggest that maybe the Saudis have managed to regain enough territory to feel they can sit down and talk, and maybe the Houthis, their opponents, or their principal opponents, have also been worn down by attrition, and maybe some peace will come of this, but I wouldn't be optimistic.
Well, Robert Lacey, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's always a pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Lacey, who's a British historian and author of numerous international bestsellers, among them The Kingdom, a study of Saudi Arabia, published in 1981, Ford, The Men and the Machines, and Great Tales from English History. His latest book is Inside the Kingdom, Kings, Clerics, Modernists, Terrorists, and the Struggle for Saudi Arabia. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the impact on British politics that the election of a socialist, Jeremy Corbyn, as head of the Labour Party, will have.
Reflects our democracy. Those praying voices on the right of the house are echoed down the street of shame, where politics mix with bingo and tits in a money and numbers game, where they offer you a feature on stockings and suspenders next to a call for stiffer penalties.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Harold Clark, a professor in the School of Economics, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He has been a co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. And his latest book is Affluence, Austerity, and Electoral Change in Britain. And his forthcoming book is Austerity and Political Choice in Britain. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harold Clark.
Hello, Ian.
So, Harold, the election of Jeremy Corbyn as the new head of the Labour Party, he's referred to as a socialist, and I'm sure he probably doesn't disagree with that. Of course, he's immediately a lot of pundits are making an analogy with Bernie Sanders, who, by the way, Bernie Sanders says, I'm delighted by Jeremy Corbyn's victory. So let's start with that in terms of a comparison. Is there something that you could relate to in terms of comparisons between the insurgent candidate in the Democratic primaries, Bernie Sanders, and the new head of the British Labour Party?
Oh, I think so, for sure. Both Sanders in the U.S. and Corbyn in Britain, of course, are very much outsiders to their parties, you know, both to the far left. And, of course, it's not unusual to label oneself a socialist in the U.K., although it certainly is over here. But the kinds of populist, discontent with the establishment that is doing so much to animate politics in a lot of countries these days, I think is readily seen in both the support that we see for both of these people.
So there's also, I guess, an analogy in a way with Tony Blair and Bill Clinton, in as much as they are the leaders of both the Democratic Party and the Labour Party, that gravitated in the case of Clinton to Wall Street and in the case of Blair to the City of London's financial centre. And Tony Blair has been extremely outspoken in criticising the ascension of Jeremy Corbyn to head the Labour Party. He considers it an unmitigated disaster, and there's great concern now about Britain's relations with the EU, with Scotland, with its foreign policy, and particularly its defence policy and NATO membership. So walk us through those arguments, if you will, in terms of are they similar to the arguments between the left of the Democratic Party here and the centre or the what was called the Democratic Leadership Council that brought Clinton in?
Well, I think so, Ian, to some extent, although there is, of course,
an important difference. If you go back to the early 1990s, the really great move for both the Democrats in the U.S., but especially for Labour in Britain, of course, was to basically adopt, to embrace capitalist economics with the idea of using the money that would be generated to further socialist ends. And that was a remarkably successful political move in both countries, of course, with Blair in the U.K. and Bill Clinton over here doing extremely well. In Labour's case, of course, Blair led Labour to three majority victories, including the 1997 landslide. Although in recent years, things, of course, have not gone so well for Labour, and especially, I think, disappointing in this 2015 election, where all the polls had them running neck and neck or even slightly ahead of the Conservatives. So from the point of view of guys like Corbyn's supporters, people who support Jeremy Corbyn, they can say now, well, look, the Blairite approach is not one that works electorally. It looks like it wasn't good economics. Look at the great crash and the subsequent recession, and now look at what's happened to us politically. So I think their argument is that they don't accept the premise that, adopting Blairite or Clintonite economic policies is a road to political success.
So is there a groundswell in England? Because Miliband was considered on the left of the Labour Party, and he got a drubbing in this last election. And he tried to, hang out with the iconoclastic British comedian. It didn't do him any good, talking, street talk with Russell Brand. So, what's happening with the younger generation in England? Are they sort of kind of apolitical like the millennials appear to be in this country, or are they getting more politically active?
Well, I think they're a very diverse group, just as they are here in the United States. But the one sort of key thing that you can see is generally their lack of involvement or relative lack of involvement in politics. That said, I do think that Mr. Corbyn this summer has touched a nerve and mobilized a number of younger people who may have been sympathetic to Labour and to some of the ideas that Corbyn has enunciated. But, he was able to get them actually involved and to go out and vote. And, of course, the results are clear with his, sort of crushing victory in the election for the leadership. So, if you're talking about young people, Ian, the big thing to note, though, generally is their lack of engagement. And so it is quite noteworthy that it looks like Corbyn has had some effect in bringing some of them back.
And again, I'm speaking with Harold Clark, who's a professor in the School of Economic, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. His latest book is Affluence, Austerity and Electoral Change in Britain, and his forthcoming book is Austerity and Political Choice in Britain. So if you wouldn't mind, Harold, it sort of mystifies me how you could have an election, as the last election that Cameron won, and I think it was somewhat unexpected, but he did much better than certainly the pollsters thought. And, of course, the big winner in that election was the new Scottish Nationalists, whose victory appeared to be entirely at the expense of Labour, and it's going to be hard for Labour to come back. But, for example, the fact that UKIP, which is the right-wing nativist party there, got, I think, about, 14% of the vote, but only ended up with one seat in the parliament? I mean,
close to 13%, but only a single seat in parliament.
Right. So, and what kind of percentage did the Scottish Nationalists get?
The Scottish Nationalists, who got 56 of 59 seats north of the border in Scotland, only got about 4% of the vote. So can see there's really massive distortions in the first-past-the-post electoral system that Britain uses. And this is not unusual. This happens fairly regularly, that we have quite large distortions. After all, Tony Blair won his last election in 2005 with only 35% of the popular vote. And so this is a fairly regular thing in British politics, and it's working very heavily against UKIP right now, who by any sort of democratic standard deserve a lot more representation at Westminster than they're getting.
Well, but how could that be? How could a party get 13% of the vote and only get one seat, and the Scottish Nationalists get 3% of the vote and get 52 seats?
Well, it all has to do with concentration of your votes. And in the Scottish case, of course, all of the SNP votes are, in fact, in Scotland. They're highly concentrated, and so it really pays off in terms of their ability to translate votes into seats. UKIP is exactly the opposite. Their vote is scattered all over England. There's a few votes in Scotland as well, but basically scattered all over England, and as a result, they can get lots of votes, but they can't come first in any constituency, with the sole exception of Douglas Carswell out in Clacton, out in Essex. And so, it's all about concentration in a first-past-the-post system, all about concentration.
Hmm. Well, that's interesting, and I don't know how you'd ever overcome that. It's sort of, what is it? It's almost like nativism in a way that... Or regionalism, I guess, it would be the only explanation.
Well, the Scottish case is very similar to the case in Quebec in Canada during the 70s and 80s and into the 90s, where an independence, a separatist party, the Bloc Québécois, was able to win virtually every seat in the 1993 Quebec, in Quebec in that 1993 federal election. There are very, very strong parallels there, and exactly the same villain, if you will, that first-past-the-post electoral system, which so heavily rewards concentrated strength.
Well, let's turn to foreign policy, where already the foreign policy and defence establishment in the UK is having heartburn about Jeremy Corbyn, even though he's not Prime Minister by any means, he's got an uphill climb in the next election since Labour has been decimated by the rise of the Scottish parties. But nevertheless, let's go through some of the areas of contention. That he's extremely pro-Palestinian, which is pretty much universally in Europe, more so than they are pro-Israel, as they are here. Nevertheless, a lot of people think he's too pro-Palestinian, he's too pro-Hamas, he's too pro-Hezbollah, he was close to Sinn Féin, the Irish IRA people, the unionists in the north hate him. He's talked about getting rid of the Trident submarine program, which is the big defence ticket item in UK defence spending. A lot of it to me, though, is that Britain itself is punching above its weight militarily and is sort of coming to a reckoning. And conversely, the Germans, who are the real power in Europe, are reluctantly having to assume a leadership role. So let's start from that broader premise. Is what's happening in England, a sort of inevitable downsizing of their role on the international stage?
Yeah, I think this is something, of course, that... the British have been pushing back against, for almost half a century, really, since the end of the Second World War. Maybe that's a good date to start it. Britain does want to punch above its weight, and continues to try to be an active player along with the United States in terms of the use of military force around the world, and. So a guy like Corbyn, to some extent, is simply telling truth to power in terms of what Britain might achieve. But it's really more than that, of course, because he wants to actually do things, like you said, to get out of NATO, to get rid of a nuclear capability, to change Britain's involvement in terms of coalitions supporting who we support in the Middle East and why and so forth. He wants to change all of these things. So it's not just about the size of the defense budget. It goes well beyond that. What he's saying, Ian, really echoes the themes of left politics in Britain in the 50s and 60s. He's back to the campaign for nuclear disarmament and so on and so forth. All these things that were, such a big deal in inter-party, inter-labor struggles back in the 60s and 70s and so on. He's brought all that back. He's from that generation, and it's all back.
So this is like Clement Attlee, is it? Going back to, because Clement Attlee was accused of being a big appeaser. I remember Attlee gave Stalin the latest British military technology, which was the Rolls-Royce jet engine, which, of course, shortly thereafter, Russian MiGs were shooting down British planes in Korea.
Yes. Well, I think so. The attitudes towards what was then the Soviet Union and so forth, you can see echoes of this in statements that Corbyn makes. And there's just, I call this the politics of ideological nostalgia in our new book that you mentioned earlier. And it's really, back with a force with a guy like Corbyn. There's no doubt about it. It goes well beyond, as I say, the size of the defense budget or particular kinds of decisions about military hardware. It's a sort of fundamental reorientation ideologically where Britain stands in the world and the kinds of things that it stands for.
So just in the last minute or so then, what's your take on Jeremy Corbyn? I know the program director here at KBOK, Alan Minsky, was recently in London. He spent some time with him and found him to be extremely impressive. But I don't know much about him. So what do you know about him?
I don't know a lot about him myself. I've unlike Nigel Farage with UKIP, who I've actually met recently, I've not met Mr. Corbyn. Some of my colleagues that I work with have. And in fact, in the case of one of them, Paul Whiteley, has known Corbyn like since the 1970s, and they worked together in the Labour Party and so forth. So I can't really sort of help you out in terms of, what sort of a guy is he. Everything I read suggests that he is, an extremely dedicated man to his various causes, has been all his life, and continues to be. How he'll do in the rough and tumble of Westminster politics, I think, remains to be seen. And, of course, in that regard, one of the big themes is going to be the extent to which his enemies within the party will be able to work, whether people will work with him or his enemies will oust him. I think that's a real possibility that Labour, that might happen, or Labour might even split, as it did, of course, in 1981.
Well, it's also what happened, of course, to the Labour Party in Australia, that internal fighting led them into oblivion. I thank you for joining us, Harold Clark.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise. And again, I've been speaking with Harold Clark, who's a professor in the School of Economic, Political and Policy Studies at the University of Texas at Dallas. He has been the co-investigator of the British Election Study, which is housed at the University of Manchester, where he's also a visiting professor. His latest book is Affluence, Austerity and Electoral Change in Britain. And his forthcoming book is Austerity and Political Choice in Britain. We're going to take a brief station break, and we will be back speaking with Adele Stand about her column at the American Prospect, A Nation of Sociopaths, What the Trump Phenomenon Says About America.
You really are, then you won't be right.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. Up until recently, she served as the Washington bureau chief at Alternet and is currently a columnist for The American Prospect, where she just wrote the article, A Nation of Sociopaths, Question, What the Trump Phenomenon Says About America. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adele Stan.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And Adele, in your article, you ask the question whether, as some people are claiming, the Donald Trump candidacy is good for the Democrats. But more to the point, as you argue, is the spewing forth of racism, nativism, and misogyny into the public arena good for America?
Right. Well, you know, and the thing is, even that question, to me, doesn't even quite get at what the real issue is here, Ian, and it's what the hell is the matter with America that this guy, that this racist, misogynist, nativist, you name it, clown is the front runner of one of our two major political parties. You know, in the world of partisan politics, folks who identify themselves as Democratic voters or as liberals or as progressives, you know, we tend to see ourselves as outside of this phenomenon. And yet, when you look at what happens when Donald Trump is on any public affairs program, news program, Sunday talk show, the ratings skyrocket. And people will say, oh, well, it's only, you know, 20% of the Republican base, which is itself a slice of the electorate, that supports him. But a whole lot, a much greater slice of the Republic will tune in to watch him, and that makes money for media. And so, well, what's the matter with America that we find this so mesmerizing?
Well, I guess you know, let's face it. I think we've had game show politics for some time, and
right. That's
what it's now out in the open. Let's get some perspective though. My understanding on the number of Americans who vote in Republican primaries is only, what, about 3 or 4%? What's your...
I don't know the numbers either. Yeah. I haven't looked them up, but yes, it is a tiny percentage.
So to that extent, his influence is being exaggerated. But the point you just made is that the fact that he's so clever at attracting media means that an awful lot of people are following it, and whether they're following it out of some kind of vicarious schadenfreude or whether they really are really climbing aboard the Trump clown car, what's your sense?
Well, I don't think it's so much that the whole of the electorate is climbing aboard the car, right? But what I do think is that there is a vicarious thrill that many people get from seeing somebody who unabashedly articulates things that they themselves may believe but wouldn't dare to say. You know, I think there's that. I think there's also just the worship of mammon here. I mean, I think that there's also the whole worship of money and sort of the great man theory of capitalism, if you will, you know, the notion of individualism expressed through the ability to accumulate wealth, that is very much, you know, that's part of the American self mythology from the beginning, that is so compounded by the way in which Trump presents himself. And I think that is appealing to a lot of people. There's something like, that they might not even completely like him as a person, but they find something admirable in these qualities, that he will say things that no one else would dare to say, and that he has a ton of money and he loves to flaunt it. I think that this is not simply a Republican problem. I don't think this is simply, I think this is, you know, this is a side of America that, you know, that is now being expressed with great force.
Well, one of the things I find extraordinary about the American right is that their icons, like Ronald Reagan and John Wayne, for example, don't have to be authentic. I mean, neither Ronald Reagan or John Wayne put on the uniform. They put on the uniform of the United States, but they didn't fight in the wars.
Fight, right.
But they were able to sort of become the exemplars of heroism. And in the case of this CNN debate with the Republican candidates on Wednesday, we know that Donald Trump's going to go after Carly Fiorina and point out that her business record is totally fraudulent. She tanked a huge company, Hewlett-Packard. She took it into the basement. But on the other hand, his wealth is apparently highly exaggerated. There's some rumors that he's not even a billionaire. So it's hard to know. In fact, I've heard rumors that the Romney people are planning to, you know, basically bribe him to get out of the race to really make him a billionaire. So, and they've got the money.
They do have the real money,
exactly.
Right? They have all the venture capital money, hedge fund money, all
right.
That. Yeah.
So wouldn't it be a wonderful irony that the billionaire is actually, you know, really does need his television job?
Well, you know, I have a secret suspicion, and this is totally, I'm making this up, Ian, here, and I probably should not be doing that, but I would be surprised if Donald Trump doesn't have videographers on his plane and on his helicopter and on all his behind-the-scenes prep for this stuff, and it's going to be one hell of a reality show after he pulls out of the race. But yes, that would be a delicious irony. And you and I have talked over the years many times, and you've raised the issue of the hypocrisy of right-wing heroes. I remember you bringing up when we were discussing the religious right, you know, the Reagan's divorce and all of this. And it is true that these right-wing icons do not have to be authentic. They simply have to represent something. I mean, I have seen Donald Trump, you know, address the dinner at the Family Research Council. It was a couple years ago, you know. I mean, they invited him. They wanted him there. You know, the thrice married, you know, idolater.
Right. Casino owner. Casino owner from the Sodom and Gomorrah of New York City. Yes. Yeah. Well, let me again remind the audience I'm speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. Up until recently, she served as the Washington Bureau Chief at Alternet and is currently a columnist for The American Prospect, where she just wrote the article, A Nation of Sociopaths, What the Trump Phenomenon Says About America. Now, for all the talk about how Trump is giving the Republican Party and the Republican establishment heartburn, I would think the fact that Trump is bringing out the Reagan Democrats, the blue-collar Americans who vote Republican, and, of course, many argue against their own interests, that's probably helpful for them, unless, you know, if the establishment stabs him in the back in such a way that his followers are upset, then they may not vote. So isn't that a bit of a dilemma for them? How do they ease him out without doing a kind of Brutus, stabbing Caesar in the back?
Well, of course, and there was this big meeting between Reince Priebus and Donald Trump last week at Trump Tower. So Trump had the home field advantage, at which he was asked to sign this pledge that he would not run third party. And so Trump said he agreed to sign the pledge pending, you know, that he would be treated fairly by the Republican National Committee. Reince Priebus is the chairman of the Republican National Committee. And so the thing is, well, who gets to decide, you know, who is treating Donald Trump fairly? I think Donald Trump is reserving that place for himself. So he does sort of have them over a barrel, but you are quite right that, he is drawing a great deal of attention. I mean, it's not just the media, you're right, that are benefiting by the attention that, you know, a debate featuring Donald Trump, you know, is drawing. So he is drawing a lot of eyeballs to what's going on within the Republican Party, and it does seem that Ben Carson in some ways is the beneficiary of that, who's running second among the GOP field. So I think you're right. It does draw what used to be known as the Reagan Democrats. It does draw them to, you know, the draws Trump's attention, draws their attention to Trump. But and it does. So he does, in a way, have them over a barrel. The RNC, the Republican establishment. He is a mischief maker, and he also is a mischief maker for the Koch brothers, who I am sure expected to have a lot more control over the primary process than they have, thanks to Trump, because of the way he can command media. Now, that being said, how, if I were Reince Priebus, Ian, what I would do is just kind of, given the situation, sit back, because I think that, now I do think Trump could win New Hampshire. I don't know if he will win Iowa. I think Carson could surge in Iowa if he has a good enough organization there. South Carolina, maybe Trump could win that. I don't know. He is a New Yorker, and he is a Yankee. But then when you get into other primaries, I think as soon as Donald Trump loses one or two, he'll take himself out, because he can't stand to lose anything, you know, at least not in the public view. He doesn't mind, you know, driving a casino into the ground and declaring, you know, Chapter 11 and going bankruptcy and screwing his creditors. But he doesn't want to lose in the public view. So I think he could take himself out. And of course, then the question becomes, if he has a way to say he hadn't been treated fairly, and then he sets himself up to do a third party run, which wouldn't be a real run, because what it takes to get on the ballot in every state in the union is just an insurmountable obstacle, but it could cause mischief.
Well, but in the first debate on Fox, where obviously Rupert Murdoch and Roger Ailes got their minions to try and destroy him, that backfired. Right. And he managed to make all of the other Republicans on the stage, with a couple of exceptions, look like, you know, the sort of fatuous, money-grubbing polls that they are by pointing out that many of them had asked him for money. And I think the public loves that stuff. So there'll probably be more of that in the CNN debate, even though the field is even a little crowded now with Fiorina joining it, that you will end up, you know, so far what Trump's been doing is he's absolutely been making Jeb Bush look like a feckless, you know, out of touch, spoiled brat.
That he actually is, probably.
Yeah, and then Walker has all but disappeared. Rand Paul has disappeared.
Right.
They're just dropping like flies.
They are,
because all the oxygen's being taken out of the room by Trump. So I don't know whether they're going to survive. If you're saying he may not survive, who would survive then? To your mind.
Well, see, here's the thing. You know, Marco Rubio's having a tough go, right? He's almost disappeared. Yet, I think he's probably the most dangerous to the Democrats if he could get the nomination. So, oh, crap.
What's up? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah.
Hello?
Yeah.
I'm so sorry. I don't know what's going on. Are you there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm hearing a buzz on my a busy signal on my end.
Oh, there you go. Yeah,
yeah.
Just
sorry.
Don't take calls while we're on the air. Okay. Sorry. So go ahead. I was going to ask.
Yeah. So So, I mean, I think if Trump got out of the primaries, then I think that gives the Kochs more room to push somebody. Now, you know, the Kochs always make a big deal about getting somebody who mirrors their ideology, but in the end, they always go with whomever the establishment candidate is because they want to win. And so I could see the Kochs lining up behind Jeb or behind Marco Rubio. But they'd have to do it soon. I mean, we're not all that far away from Iowa and New Hampshire, which is where you have so much momentum. So I don't know. It's a crazy race, Ian. I'm not feeling confident in my own prognostications, which I know I'm not supposed to admit. But but I do think with this coming debate, what's going to be really interesting is, of course, everybody's kind of getting out the popcorn to watch the Fiorina v. Trump thing, but the thing to remember about that is that Fiorina herself has set herself up to be the person to take on Hillary, right? She's really positioning herself for Veep, for a running mate slot, and that's the person who throws the punches, right? And because she's a woman, she'd be in a better position to say mean things about Hillary. But if she's going to be a proxy in that regard, in this debate, she will probably be a proxy for how people feel about Hillary on a gendered sense, and Trump will be able to play that. Mm-hmm. She'll be sort of the substitute for Hillary in this debate, just simply by a factor of her gender. So I think that there's a whole lot of social undercurrent in this whole GOP contest, crazy contest.
Well, if you say, Adele Stan, that Fiorina's running for vice president, the person who's clearly running for vice president, or at least that's the default position, is Marco Rubio. I think he's almost a shoo-in as a VP. But when she ran here in the state of California against Barbara Boxer,
right.
She got absolutely trounced.
She did.
And she was caught on TV just being absolutely. I don't even know whether. Can I use the B-I-T-C-H-Y word? But in the worst kind of way, she was caught. And she's obviously an extremely unpleasant person.
She's an unpleasant person. She truly is. But, here's the thing. Trump is an unpleasant person, too, but women are not allowed to be unpleasant. and that's the problem that she's dealing with. I don't see her as a great politician, but I've been fascinated by the way she has played the gender card within the GOP. I mean, that's how she got into this debate in the first place. She marshaled all of these right-wing women to make the case for her, and they called out Reince Priebus as well as CNN for putting up obstacles to her being part of the race. And these right-wing women, we're talking about the head of the Concerned Women for America and the Susan B. Anthony list and all of these anti-choice groups. So they really set it up as a gender contest, and so, that she was being excluded for her gender.
Well, Adele, we've run out of time, and I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
Thanks so much for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Adele Stan, who's a journalist based in Washington, D.C., who specializes in covering the intersection of religion and politics. Up until recently, she served as the Washington Bureau Chief at Altenet and is currently a columnist for The American Prospect, where she just wrote the article, A Nation of Sociopaths, What the Trump Phenomenon Says About America. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.